Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with the authors of two amazing debut story collections. The first is Blake Sands, a Louisiana native and the author of The Boundaries of Their Dwelling. We'll also hear from Andrew Segrist, who graduated from the University of New Orleans Creative Writing Workshop. His new collection is called We Imagined It Was Rain. It's a great pleasure to welcome Blake Sands to The Reading Life. Blake is originally from Baton Rouge, studied creative writing at Loyola University, and then earned his MFA at the University of Notre Dame. He now teaches at the University of Denver. His first story collection, The Boundaries of Their Dwelling, is the winner of the prestigious Iowa Award for Short Fiction. These beautiful stories are deeply rooted in Louisiana. Blake Sands, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've been away for a while, but Blake, you are writing such wonderful Louisiana stories.
Well, thank you. I have been away a while. I do try to get back as often as possible. Usually that means about 6 or 7 times a year. And if I can have anything to do with it, it'll be a week at a time sometimes. So I try to stay connected to what's going on back home, back in Baton Rouge and in New Orleans. I feel that one way to do that is to just read the paper. So that's one way that I try to feel connected to Louisiana.
Well, given where we are in New Orleans right now, I thought it would be interesting to talk about Hurricane Gothic. It's one of those stories that's both timeless and timely, about a family, their land, the house that sits on it, a house that's more fragile than you might think. So I wonder if you might read the beginning of that story for us.
Sure, I'd love to. It's called Hurricane Gothic. Hear the first two paragraphs. Summer 1964. A wedding. In the gnat-filled heat of a Louisiana backyard, a small-town couple jumped the broomstick. The modest ceremony took place at the newly built house of a family friend, a self-taught handyman who had made a killing fixing up houses after Hurricane Audrey. The groom professed to love his little lady better than anyone could ever think to do, and the bride countered that he better because her daddy would never let him live it down if he didn't. At 18, they were the first of the baby boomers in that town to get married. Ben, prone to raising a little hell, firstborn charmer of a local Pacific Theater vet. Anne, drum major for the Holden High Hornets and newly minted Avon girl of the Livingston Parish chapter. A distant uncle had died that spring, and in his will, he left Ben a plot of land at the edge of the river. Ben didn't question his luck. These were the 60s. Anything was possible. He took the gift as his due and set to building his bride a house. The job would have daunted others, but behind his mischievous eyes, Ben possessed the will of a mule. He used old drawings of his father's childhood house as a blueprint. Before the flood of 1958 ravaged it, that old-timey cabin stood in the swell and sway of fertile land tucked in the gentle curve of Blood River. It was a hidden Eden. Satsuma trees in a grove, blackberries on the vine, Katrina and Rita, not yet even flutters on a butterfly's wing. Like a penitent to Lourdes, Ben pilgrimaged to the abandoned flood site for salvageable wood. Hand-cut relics of oak and cypress lay half-buried beneath the tall grass. Shutters and cabinets, hardwood slats and varnished shelves, humble prisms of rural life. He sorted through the debris. Here, a cypress plank from an old kitchen shelf from which his father, the story went, nearly fell to his death at age 6. There, a hand-carved post from his old man's childhood bed, notched with knife slits to mark his father's growth. From the homestead's muck and ruin, Ben gathered wooden talismans and imagined new purposes for each. This bedpost could become a stair rail on his porch, that kitchen shelf a floorboard in his new living room. Each slat became a story, every watermark a warning.
Oh, I love that. I love that because that's what houses are in so many ways here.
They are. The idea of home is one thing. The idea of a house is similar and yet equally compelling to me. You know, I grew up in a very old house in Baton Rouge that came with a lot of history from throughout my family years in a way that kind of reminds me a little bit maybe of Sarah Broom's The Yellow House. And so I'm used to living in old houses. I prefer old houses myself. I love hearing the stories of people who have lived in them, and I love the stories that they carry.
One of my favorite stories about houses came from Barb Johnson, who teaches here at UNO and was a carpenter for a long time. And she would write little notes about the houses she had worked on and tuck them in the walls for people to find in the future to know she had been there and she had done this work. And I always thought that is such a New Orleans kind of thing to find messages in the walls in that way. But this is a story about stubbornness and resilience and, you know, what home means and the sudden shock of having it taken from you.
Yeah, these characters are resilient. They're flawed. I think you'll see, if you're out there reading the book or interested in it, that a lot of the stories have to do with fathers and sons, and this is no different. We have a father in the story whose resilience comes in the form of rebuilding after so many different floods, and for the son, his resilience comes from trying to get over a drug addiction in a couple of different ways and over a couple of different settings. So, yeah, I think resilience is something that is important to these characters.
One of the things you've done so beautifully is use the town of Rain, Louisiana, as a setting in some of these stories.
That's right.
So talk about the city of murals and the home of the Frog Festival.
Sure. I mean, it's sort of lore in my own head that was gifted to me from my mom. You know, my mom is from Baton Rouge. Her family comes from the river parishes, from Gramercy, from Lutcher. It's where my grandmother was from, and my grandfather was from Springfield and Livingston Parish. But then my father's from Mexico, and when he first came to this country, he had, believe it or not, his own set of relatives way back in his lineage who were from the area around Rain, from Eunice, from Rain itself. And so that was his thought on where he might try to make a go of it as a newly minted American resident. And so I've heard many stories about Rain throughout the years from my family, from both sides of it, actually. As I got to be a teenager and into my 20s, I started to learn about the Frog Festival that happens every year there and to go to it and to learn about the city's murals and visit all the different crazy murals that are on the interstate underpass and different buildings in the town. I can remember taking my mom there to show her around. She hadn't been there in many years, and that was really something else for me. Yeah, I mean, the place just, I feel like I've got ties to it from both sides of my family, and it's sort of in the heart of that area of Louisiana where there's so much to do that feels of a piece with storytelling. There's just such great music venues to see live music. There's such great food. These festivals are places for communion and for storytelling. So it was a natural place for me to want to set a few stories.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Blake Sands, a Louisiana native and the author of The Boundaries of Their Dwelling. Everywhere in this book is the Iliad and the Odyssey and the idea of getting home and what that means in dream and reality.
Right.
So talk about how important that's been as a shaping idea for you.
Sure.
You want to come back home, I think.
Can't you tell from reading the book?
I know.
It's true. I talk about it all the time to people here. I'm sure they're just tired of hearing it and probably just want me to do it already. Not that Denver isn't lovely. Yeah, the idea of returning home appears in many of the books. You mentioned the Iliad and the Odyssey. And, of course, there is that one story where the bus breaks down, the basketball team's in the middle of Mississippi. And I don't know for others of your listeners, but for me, I've always felt like Mississippi is this weird, epic land of Faulkner and big stories. I think of the Coen brothers' take on Mississippi, where they literally transform Mississippi into a version of the Odyssey and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And so when I was going to have a story set in Mississippi and I knew I had a character who was literally reading the Odyssey, I thought, well, it would be fun to play with some of those old myths and make them a part of my own writing. But in terms of this idea of like how that concept is throughout the whole book. Home is just such a vast thing for so many of us. It defines us in such essential ways, and our senses of home change over time so much that it really wasn't so much an intentional decision to thematize the book around that as much as it was that those were the concerns that I was having in my own life as I moved from, I used to teach at LSU, so moving from Baton Rouge, my little hometown, to a place in Denver that I knew nothing about, that was something that was happening as I was writing these stories. So I've always come home for Mardi Gras every year. I've always come home to visit family and friends every year. So I've often felt like I was in two places trying to establish some sort of sense of myself here in Denver versus who I was when I would come home. Sometimes I would feel a difference between those two. And so I think it just sort of came out in the writing that I was doing in that time naturally. Mm-hmm. It was only later, maybe, in the last 3 or 4 years as I started to curate the stories and arrange them, that I started to see what you're seeing, that those themes were there. So to whatever extent they were intentionally arranged around that theme, it came in that later stage of the revision process.
Well, the sense of your voice on the page is clear and strong, I have to say. What did it mean to you to win this award? It's such a prestigious prize.
I mean, it just changes everything, Sue. It's such a big deal. I've been writing in obscurity for a very long time. And so more than anything, it just gives me the confidence to keep going, to keep writing the things that I was otherwise working on. There's been such a flurry of activity around the book. It's been exciting. And that's fantastic. The very fact that I'm talking to you is evidence of that. those sorts of things that come along with publishing a book are things that I've always appreciated in watching the journeys of my friends who have published books, and in watching the journeys of people who I don't know, whose books I admire. So to be a part of that from the other side is pretty wondrous.
Well, I'm glad to see you have a novel underway, too.
I do, that's right. I do.
Let's hope the wait's not too long. We've been talking with Blake Sands, whose new story collection, the winner of the Iowa Award for Short Fiction, is The Boundaries of Their Dwelling. You can meet him Sunday, October 24th at 4 at the Baton Rouge Gallery. That's as part of their Sundays at 4 series, or at an artist-in-resident event Wednesday, November 3rd, from 6 to 7:30 at the Chloe Hotel in New Orleans. Blake, thank you so much.
Of course. It was a pleasure.
It is a great pleasure to welcome Andrew Segrist to The Reading Life. He's a graduate of the University of New Orleans Creative Writing Workshop, and his first book, We Imagined It Was Rain, is the winner of the 2020 C. Michael Curtis Short Story Book Prize. Andrew, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here with you.
Now listen, you live on the Cumberland River outside of Nashville, Tennessee. Now, thanks to the internet, I can see the view from your house. And then,
it's
of course,
nice view.
It's a great view. And then, of course, you spent years in New Orleans where the Mississippi is such a defining presence. So water is everywhere in these stories. So talk a little bit for me about living along the water and how it defines the life and age you're writing and flows in and out of it.
Yeah, so it's interesting when writing a collection because you kind of don't really understand the themes of your own stories until later. Looking back, obviously, water is a big theme in a lot of these stories, and I think that is just from growing up kind of surrounded by it, constantly being out on the river, and I don't know exactly what draws me so heavily to that, but yeah, I think it's something aesthetically that I'm very connected to, whether it's rain or water or the ocean or, a lake. It's just like something that I feel very connected to and calm around, and I'm just very drawn to that.
Now talk about some of the images in this story, especially the recurring figure of that beautiful woman with colorful, long, braided eyelashes. That reads like a character out of folklore, mythical creature. So where did that come from?
Interestingly enough, that came from a writing exercise I did an undergraduate workshop. I did my undergraduate degree in the College of Charleston. And the teacher just one day gave us a writing assignment, and I don't know where that came from, but I wrote that. And for some reason, it just stuck with me, and I just kept putting it in stories. And sometimes it fit in the story, and sometimes it didn't, but I just couldn't kind of get away from it. I think the image of it really was striking to me. And so I kept coming back to it, and yeah, it made its way into a couple of these stories.
I think it's going to last. I mean, you made up your own folktale.
Well, that's the goal, I think.
However, was the teacher a man or a woman?
The teacher was a man.
There you go. I mean, I kept rubbing my eyes a little bit after the first time. How would I do that? How would that work?
I know.
But then you've adapted one real story and made it your own. And that's the story of Mary the Elephant, which appears in some of these stories. Tell us about her and how that famous event of 1916 has been passed down for generations.
So the way I came upon that story was I saw a black and white photograph of the actual event, or what they claimed to be the actual event, and it was such a haunting image of an elephant being hung by a railroad crane. And yeah, I just couldn't get away from that image. And so I just researched the actual event. And then you started thinking about like what it would be like to be in that town, you know, and see that. I think a lot of the accounts of it were at first the people were kind of excited.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of came in like sort of a mob mentality to kill this elephant. And then when it started happening, it went from this like mob coming to kill this elephant to very somber. So it started with that image, that photograph. And then, you know, I just kept imagining that town on that day.
Mm-hmm.
And like, especially the person who was responsible for carrying out that hanging.
And I went and looked for the photograph because your description of it is so amazing. And it is absolutely haunting. I mean,
yeah, it's horrifying.
It is unbelievable. So I can see why that would springboard you into this meditation about it. Now, one of the things I enjoyed the most about these stories is the way you create these unforgettable visual memories for the reader. It reminds me a bit, and forgive me if I'm totally off base here, of that Wallace Stevens poem, Anecdote of the Jar, I Placed a Jar on a Hill in Tennessee. Your first story, Whittled Bone, describes a father mourning his missing daughter by filling a jar with paper wasp.
Mm-hmm.
And those two things are going to be locked in my mind together forever now. I mean, so would you talk a little bit about that? Because your art makes such unexpected beauty plunked down in the middle of these rural landscapes, and it's both place and it's love of place, and it's something really special.
So the jar of wasps, I actually collect old mason jars and glass jars. They're kind of littered all around my house. It's funny, a teacher, an undergraduate once said, he said, I couldn't write a story without having a mason jar in it. every time I turned something in, there was mason jars all throughout the story.
Mm-hmm.
And the wasp, I just remember as a child picking up dead wasps off like windowsills in the house.
Mm-hmm.
There was sort of like an excitement and a fear of like trying to pick them up by the wings so that I thought maybe the stinger might still get me. And I don't know, I think maybe those two images kind of came together.
I'm speaking with Andrew Segrist, whose new story collection is called We Imagined It Was Rain. Now, these are stories of loss and mourning, many of them. There aren't many mothers in these stories. There are lots of mourning or dying fathers. And talk a little bit about that preoccupation, because you've recently become the father of a daughter. And I'm curious if that's changed your writing.
I didn't set out to write the stories with absent mothers and dying fathers, and because I wrote them all individually in graduate school, and looking back at them as a whole, I see the pattern, and I don't know what the preoccupation is. A friend of mine who's a writer, Neil Walsh, told me that after he had his daughter, he could not write stories the same way because it changes who you are as a writer to have a child. So I think going forward, my writing definitely will probably change a lot more present mothers and healthy, active fathers.
Well, there are stories, too, of children and their sense of obligation that are really so, so moving. I mean, in Satellites, for example, two children help their father commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And so talk a little bit about that story. That's such a moving story, and it's such an unusual situation.
So that story actually came about, I wrote it, I'd had an accident on the job site, and I'm a carpenter. And I was out for about 6 months. I had to have some pretty intensive surgery, and I was on some pain medication one day. And I can't remember, someone asked me what it felt like, and I said it felt like my bones were, the weight of my bones had disappeared or something like that.
Wow.
And so that story came from that line, and I started thinking about, you know, it's hard to kind of go back to the genesis of that story, but that line was where the whole story came out of.
But he chooses to commit suicide on a particular day.
I had an image in my head of a man kind of walking through his house, and there's telescopes at all the different windows.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just started trying to think of, you know, what his preoccupation with these telescopes was, and then what his children think of that, and how he's passed down his love of you know, looking up at the sky to his kids. And then,
yeah.
And then I started thinking about that line and like how that was going to fit in. And then I just sort of tried to kind of follow that rabbit hole down.
The great thing about all these stories is that you leave us wanting a little more. I mean, I can see almost every one of these becoming a great novel. I mean, really.
Oh, thank you.
Because they're just such interesting situations. I'm curious to hear you talk a little bit about place, because so many people love Tennessee, and Tennessee is obviously very important to you. So talk a little bit about place as an inspiration.
Yeah, so I live, like as you said before, I live on the Cumberland River outside of Nashville. It's a rural community. So like if I go out on my front porch, I can't see another neighbor. It's out in the middle of the woods. And and then my family has a place on the Cumberland Plateau in southeast Tennessee in the Appalachians. And I've kind of split a lot of my life between those two places. And so when writing these stories, I kind of just blend them together in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So I can be on the mountain on page one and be down by the river on page two. And it kind of makes sense to me, even though in real life, it geographically doesn't work out. But that's the good thing about fiction. You can kind of make up your own territory.
So what was it like for you to study creative writing in New Orleans?
This book would not be here had I not gone to New Orleans. Just the atmosphere of the workshop at UNO, it was 3 years of my life where I was just dedicated to writing stories, talking about books, being around people, you know, who wanted to discuss literature and help you with your stories and discuss, you know, how do you get published and where do you spend, you know, all the things. And so, you know, I was very grateful to have had that time to just dedicate to putting this book together.
We've been talking with Andrew Sechrist, whose stunning debut, We Imagined It Was Rain, is the winner of the 2020 C. Michael Curtis Short Story Prize. Andrew, thank you so much and congratulations.
I appreciate it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. And just a reminder, with evolving COVID restrictions, best to check with venues before attending in-person events and be sure to mask up. In New Orleans, the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library will hold another really, really old book sale Saturday, October 16th on the porch at Ladder Library. Friends only from 10 to 11, open to the public 11 to 2. Author Susan Norris Davis and illustrator Amelia Weigel of Big Easy Native Plants discuss and sign their book Saturday, October 16th at 2 at Blue Cypress Books. Lucky Bean Press hosts Poetry Night Monday, October 18th at 6:30 at Blue Cypress Books. The featured reader is Renard Boissier, followed by an open mic. proof of vaccination required for entry. Samantha Downing reads from and discusses For Your Own Good, Thursday, October 21st at 6 at Blue Cypress Books. Tickets are required, as is proof of vaccination. Andrew Segrist discusses and signs his new story collection, We Imagined It Was Rain, at a live ticketed event Tuesday, October 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up, Blake Sands discusses and signs The Boundaries of Their Dwelling, Sunday, October 24th at 4 at the Baton Rouge Gallery as part of their Sundays at 4 series. Or you can meet him at an artist-in-residence event Wednesday, November 3rd from 6 to 7:30 at the Chloe Hotel in New Orleans. The Louisiana Book Festival goes virtual this year, October 30th through November 13th, with new and free content every weekend. Check out louisianabookfestival.org for complete schedule. And for those of you who want to donate books to the Symphony Book Fair, the South's oldest and largest continuously running used book sale, donations are now being accepted at the group's new warehouse. That's at 517 Timesaver Avenue in Elmwood on Tuesdays and Fridays from 10 to 2. Gently used books, hardcover and paperback, art, sheet music, CDs and DVDs, audiobooks, puzzles, and games are accepted. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.